It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. Later in the program, we'll talk about a proposed bill that would prohibit employers from asking workers and job applicants for their social media passwords.
First, though, it's time for our nostalgia segment, where we take a look back at lost items from our past and times and places gone by.
Our next guest recently discovered an item from his past that got him thinking. That item was a dictionary from the mid-70s. He says the book is important less for what it contains than for what it represents.
Well, joining us now is David Ulin. He's the book critic for the Los Angeles Times, and he wrote a piece about his recent experience. We've got a link to that on the Central Time Facebook page. David, welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Well, tell us about this dictionary that you found. What happened?
Well, my son, my oldest child, is getting ready to go to college, and we were helping him pack up his room, and in the closet he found an old dictionary that I didn't even remember having given him, that had been given to me when I left home for the first time. It was a mid-1970s Webster's Collegiate Dictionary, leather-bound, with my initials monogrammed into it, and it was striking because I'd forgotten that this book even existed, let alone having given it to him, but then actually holding the physical object really brought back a lot of memories.
What kind of memories did it bring back?
Well, memories of sort of leaving home for the first time. I mean, you know, it's a bittersweet experience to have your child leave home for the first time, which I've been wrestling with, and it gave me a bit of a sense into what maybe my own parents had been feeling when I left home for the first time.
Now, this dictionary itself, was it meaningful to you as you know, a place where you go for words, or was it just really more like a symbolic thing?
It really a symbolic thing. I mean, it's, you know, it was, as I said in the piece I wrote, I'm not really a dictionary person. I mean, I love words. I spend my life playing with them, working with them, thinking about them, but I tend to get them more out of context. I pick up words from pieces of writing that I'm reading, and then I will look them up and use dictionaries in that way, but I don't really go to a dictionary as a source of that kind of thing. And this dictionary also, because it was a smaller dictionary, it wasn't particularly comprehensive. It wasn't a dictionary I ever really used. It was more important to me even when I was a kid as an object, as something, you know, that my mother had given me, rather than something that I used in a practical way. I think one of the reasons I gave it to my own son, and I must have given it to him when he was very young, you know, like sixth grade or seventh grade, was that it was a fairly basic dictionary, and I thought it might be useful for him at that age. But it really was kind of the idea of something that was passed down through a couple of generations and then sort of weirdly was passed back to me because my son returned it to me.
He didn't want it?
He didn't want it.
That's too bad. He should keep it. It's a family heirloom now.
Yeah, well, I have it now. So it's, you know, it's unearthed, which is kind of interesting. And I know where it is. It's sitting on my desk and it'll probably stay there.
So I suppose it's probably not terribly useful if it's from the 70s. You can't look up words like internet, for instance.
Right. There's a lot of words that aren't in it, although I was actually struck by how many electronic. I think as I wrote in the piece, there was a lot of words about cybernetics and cyborg. So, you know, that was already infiltrated the culture, you know, almost 40 years ago. And, of course, there are those kind of words that remain. But I think the other thing for me that's interesting is that it really does illustrate how language is alive and changing and always in a state of process and of evolution. And there's something really beautiful about that, I think. I mean, I love the idea of language as a living thing. And these dictionaries, which are almost, you know, snapshots of the moment in which they're published, can illustrate that. A dictionary from 40 years ago really shows us sort of what remains and what is different, and I think there's great value in that.
You know, so much of the written word right now is going online, is going digital, and it's not something that we can hold in our hands like you're holding that 1970s dictionary that you found. Is something lost there? Are you nostalgic for that at all, or is it just the way of the world?
Well, you're talking to someone who has, you know, 5,000 books in his house, so yeah, I don't know that I would use the word nostalgic exactly, because to me they are not artifacts of the past. I use those books in my work all the time. I'm not a Luddite, and I'm not generally a backwards looker. And so for me, the real key is, are people reading? My daughter, for instance, who's 14, reads across platforms. You know, she'll read hard copy books. She'll read on a phone. She'll read on a computer. It doesn't really matter to her. And I think that, you know, electronic reading devices and, you know, electronic reading media, if it opens up more people to reading, then that's a great thing. But as for me, I partly because of my generation and partly just because of how I'm wired, I like the physical book, and for these reasons exactly, because the actual book as an object carries all sorts of associations and meanings and memories. A book that you were given by somebody, a book that a friend passed along to you, a book where you have your handwritten notes in it, or you bought it in a used bookstore and it has something. I mean, we've all bought books in used bookstores where you open them up and there's a receipt or a business card or something. These little discoveries, they don't happen with electronic books, and I'm very interested in the idea of the book as a physical object as well as a container for stories or ideas.
Now, I don't know if your mom is still with you, but did you tell her you found the book?
And yeah, in fact, not only is she with me, but I'm on vacation this week, and a big family vacation. She's actually, I mean, not physically with me in this room, but physically with me in the house I'm talking to you from. So I did mention to her that I had found the book.
Because you don't think of a dictionary as that sentimental an item, do you? You know, you think it might be something like a baseball mitt that somebody used their whole life, a parent, or, I don't know, something like a grandma's china. But a dictionary, you know, it's interesting that it has so much attachment for you.
Well, I think, again, partly it's because I'm a writer and a reader, so I do put these kind of values on books. Partly I think it's because, you know, and I think I said this in the piece, too, that, you know, that leather-bound, monogrammed edition, not really my aesthetic. I wouldn't have ever bought such a thing for myself, but it really does say something about my mother's aspirations, I think, when I was going off to school and kind of what she sort of foresaw or maybe even fantasized about, you know, the person I was going to grow into. And that's interesting, too, because I think we all have those feelings. I certainly have those feelings as I send my son off to college, you know, that kind of the aspiration or the curiosity about what the next 4 years are going to bring and what he, you know, who is the person that he's going to become. So I think in that way it becomes more than just a book. It really becomes invested with a lot of you know, the substance of the relationship.
Did either your son or your mom have any of these same feelings about this dictionary that you found?
Well, my son clearly not, since he returned it to me.
Maybe for safekeeping. It's too precious.
Maybe. I will go with that as an answer. And, you know, my mother hadn't remembered it either. So it may just be the other thing that we may sort of discover from this is that, you know, objects speak to individuals, and the object that speaks to me or that carries all those associations for me may not have those same associations, even for the other people who, you know, who once possessed it.
Well, what are your plans for this dictionary?
You know, I don't know. As I said, right now it's sitting on my desk. I wrote, you know, when we found it, I wrote that that little piece about it. My guess is it will probably, I don't imagine that I'll use it. I don't know. I'll sit with it and see what happens.
All right. Well, David, thank you so much for sharing your memories with us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
David Ulan is the book critic for the Los Angeles Times, and we've got a link to his piece, Nostalgia Jumps from the Pages of an Old Dictionary, on the Central Time Facebook page, and we want to hear what you're nostalgic for. Maybe it's another old book. Maybe it's something passed on from your family, your grandma, your grandpa, or your mother or father. Tell us what it is on the Central Time Facebook page, and we could interview you right here on Central Time.
Coming up next, we'll look at social media and privacy. Employers can look at your Facebook page, but can they request your username and password as a condition of employment? I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Thanks, Kristen. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Cynthia Schuster.
I'm Veronica Rickert. Okay, we've got a hypothetical question for you. You're offered your dream job on one condition. The employer wants the passwords to your Facebook and Twitter accounts. Do you give these employers the passwords, or do you walk away?
Well, it might sound far-fetched, but supposedly it's happening. And now a Senate committee in Wisconsin is taking up a bill today that would ban employers, landlords, and educational institutions from asking for this information. We want to hear from you. Have you had a potential employer or landlord ask you for your username and passwords to Facebook, Twitter, other social media? Did you give it to them? And tell us why or why not. Our phone number is 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org.
Joining us now is Steve Knoll. He's a marketing instructor and social media expert at Madison Area Technical College. Steve, welcome to the show.
Great. Thanks for having me.
So what do you think, Steve? Do employers have a right to be asking for this information, passwords to our social media websites?
Well, that's a very good question. The issue I think we're dealing with is technology tends to move really, really fast, and the law tends to move really, really slow. So we've got kind of that classic duality where there's this big gray space right in the middle. Technically, it's not illegal to do it, but certainly ethically, it's a big concern. So it doesn't surprise me that lawmakers are now trying to chime in on this decision.
Why right now? Why are they pushing this at this moment in time?
Well, you know, interesting. This issue has been around for a couple years now. It made some national headlines about a year ago and then just kind of faded away. But I think this summer with the whole NSA security kind of spying issue that kind of came up kind of reignited the fires under this whole privacy and what exactly people are looking and doing and watching in people's online lives. So I think it was just a matter of, you know, people have known about it, but I think it took a big thing like that to kind of bring it to the forefront.
So what are employers looking for when they seek this information?
Well, the big thing is a lot of employers, you realize that when you hire someone, they're probably going to spend, you know, 40, 50 hours a week with you working. And a lot of time people will spend more physical time with their employees than they will spend with their family and friends. So I think a lot of employers want to make sure that the person that they're hiring is someone that they actually want to work with. And a lot of times what you would find on a resume and even in a job interview doesn't necessarily reflect the personality of the product. And there's a lot of things in interviews you simply cannot ask people. And so I think a lot of them are going, well, hey, you know, I'm just going to go check out, you know, their Facebook account or Twitter and kind of get an idea of what this person is like socially to see if I really do want to spend 40 hours a week working next to them.
It seems like one thing to, you know, friend the person, the prospective employer, employee, and just sort of see what's on their page. But another, like if you give them the passwords, they have access to all of the private messages and everything like that.
Yeah, and that's the quandary that's being debated right now. Certainly, when you have a Facebook account, you can go in and set the privacy settings of what you want people who are not friends with you to be able to see. But the reality is most people don't even think to set their own privacy settings. So a lot of people, you can go in and see pretty much anything they post anyway. But I think the fact that you can kind of get in there with a password and see some things that are hidden. For example, if I knew that, you know, I was a big drinker and a big partier and I was trying to, you know, work for a company that, you know, certainly I knew had a real issue with drinking, I might be tempted to go into my Facebook page and hide those photo albums of the, you know, the summer beer party that I always hold or something like that. So I think that's what this initially is after, is people are trying to dig a little bit into the private lives of people and then kind of use that information in making that final job decision. And of course, that's where the ethical problem arises.
Mm-hmm. Well, so far we've been talking about how or speculating that employers are looking into these things as a means of getting to know their potential employees. But I was reading an article that I believe was originally reported by the AP that talking about how employers are also seeking this information or access to accounts as a way to make sure that people aren't spreading trade secrets or other proprietary information from their workplace via social media. I mean, is that even something that people are doing? And well, I'll ask you that first. I have a follow up.
Well, certainly. I mean, we live in the communications era. And the reality is we have so many different ways now to communicate with people. I mean, if you just think of how many individual email addresses many have, I just think of myself, personal email and a school email and you know, committees that I'm on and some not-for-profit companies that I do work with. We have all these different ways of communicating. Then you add in, you know, cell phones, I have a Facebook page, I have three Twitter accounts. So, you know, it's crazy how many avenues are out there. I think a lot of it is a little bit of an overreaction and a little bit of paranoia The reality is, if I'm going to work for a company and I'm going to steal trade secrets, you can do it. I mean, and really, this has been happening for 100 years, if not longer. So I think the people that are going to do stuff like that, they're going to find an outlet to do it. So employers, you know, wanting to look into a Facebook page, well, it might get me the job, but as soon as you hire me, I can just go in and change my password, and then you can't look at my Facebook page anymore. So it's kind of like a drug test. That's kind of the analogy that I'm thinking of, is companies will require a drug test to hire you, but then once you're hired, they never, ever drug test you again. Well, what was the point?
Mm-hmm. Well, so now let's think about this from the employer's perspective. We talked about how you can customize your Facebook privacy, for example, so specifically that, you know, you could block your posts from your coworkers and let your rest of your friends see everything else that you post. So if I so much as friend one of my employees, how can I still be sure that they're acting appropriately, that they're not sharing trade secrets, or say they're a nurse at a clinic and sharing anecdotal stories about patients and their medical histories, for example?
Well, and that, I think that kind of is a root issue of a bigger thing to think about. And what I've been calling it is, I've been referring to it as Generation S. So we have Generation X, we have Generation Y. Generation S is the generation of sharers. They're people that have been raised in a 24-hour a day, 7-day a week interactive world. And in the old days, you know, you would go to work at 8 o'clock in the morning or 9 o'clock, you'd flip a switch, you'd become that worker, you'd work till 5, then you'd flip the switch and go home and be a completely different person. And those two worlds would never, ever connect with each other. Nowadays, people are blending their personal life, their work life, into this big, constantly revolving cycle and doing work, because we can do it now using, you know, cell phones and other, you know, technology. You know, we can be working at 3 o'clock in the morning on a Saturday. So as a result, I think there's a lot more concern that because people are blending their personal life and their business life into a common, you know, style, a lot of businesses kind of get freaked out that the person is not the business person now, and then that, you know, other person on the weekends. And I think that's what's really kind of scaring people, is this is a generational and a philosophical different way of approaching work. And there are some people, especially people who have been growing up sharing, who are very comfortable that insist that if they're going to have a 40-hour or 50-hour work week, they want to have the flexibility to, you know, be able to return texts and Facebook, you know, all day long in exchange for also doing work all day long on their so-called off hours.
Hmm.
So that's just a very, very different philosophical way of looking at, you know, workers. And, you know, research have shown that the current young generation are some of the hardest workers now, as long as they feel passionate about what they're working for. And they're willing to work, you know, 7 days a week, as long as they can kind of work on their timeline. And the trade-off is that you get the time to interact socially during what is considered traditional business hours.
Well, Steve, I want to ask you, how common is it that employers ask for these passwords? I personally don't know anyone who's been asked for their passwords. Are employers just freaked out now because of what you just described, a change in society? Or do we need this law?
No, I think people are just freaked out. So this issue actually came up about 2 years ago. There was a case, and at this point I couldn't even tell you where in the country it was. It was not in Wisconsin that this happened, where someone was asked to provide a Facebook password. It was a very isolated incident, and that story kind of exploded. And since then, I have asked probably literally hundreds of people, because I brought this up in every class that I've taught, and nobody has ever said that it's happened to them, or that they've known anyone directly that it's happened to. It's to the point where it almost is entering the urban myth arena, that it's kind of, did this actually really happen, or is this just kind of an urban legend? It's kind of a contemporary urban legend.
And yet we've got legislation moving up the Wisconsin's food,
and that's typical, is, you know, something comes up, and then a few years later, the lawmakers kind of catch up to it. I get the impression it's, and I kind of read what the lawmakers were kind of offering, and I have to admit, I kind of rolled my eyes and said, you know, this is, it's almost made for a press conference, that it's something that a politician can stand up there and say, I'm introducing a law to better the community. And really, there are so many other ways that people can get information. And
you know, we're going to have to leave it right there for now. We'll come back and talk more about this and also take phone calls as we talk with Steve Noel about a proposed bill in Wisconsin that would ban employers, landlords, and educational institutions from asking for social media account information, including usernames and passwords.
Let us know if you've ever been asked for this information or if you think it's a good or bad idea. Our number is 1-800-642-1234. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. We'll be right back after the news. I'm Cynthia Schuster.
I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're continuing our conversation with Steve Noel about social media and privacy. And we'd like to hear from you on this one. Have you had a potential employer or a landlord, someone like that, ask for information, a password to a social media site? Or maybe you're an employer who's used these passwords to get more information, to make decisions. Well, how useful was it? You can give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@wpr.org. And you can also weigh in on the Central Time Facebook page. And we're going to go to the phones right now, take a first call from Elka in Lake Tomahawk. Hi, Elka.
Hi.
Hi there. Go ahead.
Hey, I'm just visiting Wisconsin right now, but I'm usually in the San Francisco Bay Area, and I'm a social media manager for a large company. And then in my prior position, I was an editor at a social media company itself. And I've been on both ends of kind of, for my second job, being really careful about what I had on social media when I was going to be hired. And then for my first job, actually helping to hire an assistant editor and really poring carefully over everyone's social media information and eliminating a lot of prospective employees because of what they had posted.
I see. So what do you think about a law like this? Is it necessary, or is this just the water we swim in now?
I think it's a good proactive law, given what the current is at the moment and what it probably will be. It's starting to get worse. And I think it's...
We're losing you, Elka, but thanks for that. And Steve, what do you think about what Elka said?
Well, I think it's very valid that there are businesses out there. When people go for a job interview, I think part of just the checking into it is just kind of looking out into the social arena and seeing, you know, what are they like. And the internet is full of stories of people that got a job offer and then, you know, they go onto a public site like Twitter, and then they rally, you know, against the company and saying, well, I've got to weigh off a huge paycheck versus working for a company I don't really like. And then those people, you know, they turn around and they say, well, we're not going to hire you. And I think that's very legit. I think if people are putting stuff out there voluntarily, I think it's kind of free game. And I caution my students and everyone else that, you know, I love social media, but you always have to be kind of cognizant as to what you're putting out there. The issue, I think, here is whether or not you can ask somebody for a password and really get into that extra layer that is a private layer. That's where I think the concern comes. It's almost akin to saying, you know, we'll hire you, but we're going to come to your house and take a look. You know, we're going to rifle through your underwear drawer in your bedroom in order to hire the job. That nobody's going to do that.
Well, it sounds like if this legislation passes through the, you know, the both houses of the state legislature and then is ultimately signed by Governor Walker, that would be a sweeping all out prohibition on asking for this information. I'm wondering if you see a downside to that, if there's anything that we're losing by allowing companies, landlords, educational institutions the opportunity to use these privileges if they're, you know, if they really feel that they need to be used.
Well, I don't think a lot of people are using them. I really think that this is something that's more of a rumor than an actual practicality. You know, I would really question a company. Would you want to work for a company that would be doing things like that? But you know, it's one of those interesting things about how deep people are going to go into the hiring process. I think if they pass the law, nothing's going to change, because the reality is people are still going to, you know, look at people's Facebook pages. They're going to look at their Twitter feeds. And a lot of people do not lock down these accounts. So if someone is going to kind of do this check on people, they're going to probably find, probably 98% of the time, they're going to find what they're looking for anyway. I don't think it would matter if you have a password or not.
We've got a comment here from Scott on Facebook, and he says he would walk away. Well, I know this might just be making sure I'm not giving away trade secrets. I'm never giving that info to an employer. Seems like the same thing as I'm asking for car keys to make sure everything is on the up and up. I can hardly believe that any dream job would have that kind of corporate culture. And I suppose you could take it as a warning flag of a company that might be a little bit difficult to work with.
Yeah, and I can see kind of, it depends on the nature of the company. Are you working at high level, you know, government security? You know, you have to think about that. It's, you know, or, you know, are you working at, you know, a coffee shop? You know, it's a lot different. You know, certainly any company that's involved in high level trade secrets that could be vulnerable, they're taking a lot other precautions with security checks and background checks and non-disclosure agreements and all the various other legal background checks that would go into place anyway. I think people are a little overblown, especially the whole idea that potential renters like apartments could do this in terms of, you know, discriminating against people. That kind of almost comes across as kind of vaguely disguising discrimination. And that's the one area that I think that they should be focusing more, is looking at, you know, deceptive renting policies. I think the whole thing about offering the, you know, so if someone says, you know, I'll give you a job that pays $200,000 a year if you give me your Facebook password, you know, I would be surprised how many people would actually turn that down. But in principle, I would love to say, yes, I would turn that down. But you know, again, you write a check, who knows?
Let's take a call from Stephen in Sauk City. Hi, Stephen.
Hi, thank you. And thank you, Steve, for coming on today.
Sure, thank you.
I just had a question and then more of a comment about the framing of the entire conversation and the social and current context of this entire issue. At first, I want to say that I am disappointed that an expert would dismiss something like this as a rumor. I think that we need some sort of, I mean, if it's being brought up, it's obviously an issue somewhere. But that's not my point. My point is that we're kind of framing this as, well, employers are just, you know, friendly people that are, and landlords are friendly people that are completely innocent and don't have any bad intentions, and they're just trying to find things out about their employees who have something to hide, that are trying to hide things. So that's kind of something that I take issue with, because not all employers are completely well-intentioned, and not all landlords are well, and you hit on that with landlords. And so I think framing this as employees have something to hide type thing is really a bad way to frame the conversation as a whole. And my question is, would we be discussing this the same way if your employer or landlord was asking for permission to open all of your letters, if they were asking about letters that are in your mailbox? Because mm-hmm. that's something that's protected by law. And emails and social networking now are the equivalent to letters 50 years ago.
All right, let's leave it there so we can get an answer. We're running short of time. Steve, what do you think?
Well, first of all, I just want to say that, yes, this has actually happened. These are not rumors. This has really happened. What I don't think, it's not widespread. That's the thing that I want to get across is, yes, companies have asked people. It's been documented. I just think that it's coming across with a lot of people think that this is a widespread practice. That's where I think it's more of just a rumor on that. In terms of with companies and all that, first of all, email, especially if you're using something like Yahoo or Google, anything that's considered free, well, nothing in life is free. And if you read the terms of agreement on any of these email services, it says right in there that these companies can scan through your emails and then look for keywords and use that stuff to sell your name, basically connect your name to advertisers. That's how Google and Yahoo make their money and all that. I do agree that there are bad companies out there, and I think that a law could potentially prevent a few bad companies, but I still think 98% of what is going on, this law would not touch.
And we're going to have to leave it there. Steve, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, great. Thank you. Good conversation.
Steve Noll was joining us. He's a marketing instructor and social media expert at Madison Area Technical College.
Now we take a look at water quality in Wisconsin. The Walker administration's commitment to controlling phosphorus in lakes and rivers is being tested in a permit dispute involving some major waterways. Chuck Quernbach reports.
3 years ago, under the Doyle administration, the state set up new rules aimed at cutting phosphorus pollution in surface waters, waters such as this one. A calm day on Lake Dubay along the Wisconsin River south of Wausau. Earlier this summer, the lake had just a hint of the blue-green algae that's growth is often fueled by phosphorus. Elsewhere along the Wisconsin River, the algae blooms can create what the DNR calls a pea soup scum for larger water bodies like the Peton Well and Castle Rock flowages. The DNR's Dan Helsel says it's a good idea to keep people and wildlife out of that soup.
Once those algae get to a certain density, they can actually release toxins or be hazardous to human health. But it also degrades fisheries because of low dissolved oxygen in some of the reservoirs.
The DNR and other agencies are currently doing a large study of water quality in the Wisconsin River Basin. Assessment and potential actions are still a few years away. But DNR board member William Bruins, who is a past president of the Wisconsin Farm Bureau, is already trying to shield farmers from having to do too much to reduce phosphorus-containing fertilizer from running off their fields.
One of the challenges that we have with phosphorus is that if you guys want dinner tonight, we'd better be able to continue to use phosphorus to grow our crops.
Bruins argues there's already a lot of phosphorus in some of the waters. The DNR says it's possible some of the phosphorus in sediment may be removed by dredging, or it may be possible to cap the contamination with non-toxic aluminum sulfate, or alum. The DNR's Dan Helsel says his department doesn't expect farmers to get to zero phosphorus in runoff.
We're hoping that the farmers can work with us to reduce that to the point where it's applied at crop need and we don't have excess phosphorus coming off those fields as best as possible.
Farms are not the only source of phosphorus in Wisconsin's surface waters. That's the roar of the Domtar mill at Nakusa. The company says it produces more than 100,000 tons of paper and pulp at the plant each year. But the mill also sends wastewater containing phosphorus into the Wisconsin River. In January, citizen groups challenged a reissued state wastewater permit for Domtar and one for another company, Foremost Farms. The DNR says the new Domtar permit is tougher on phosphorus, but Matt Kruger of the River Alliance of Wisconsin says if the DNR would crack down even more, that would trigger state financial help for upstream farmers to install controls on the pollutant.
The facilities can gain the same, if you can think of it as phosphorus savings, by spending less money to get into compliance with these rules. That money would go to farms and would be put in conservation practices that would hold soil in place.
Recently, a Dane County judge rejected state attempts to dismiss the case. In part, Domtar suggested the permit could be revised when the DNR finishes its study on phosphorus in the Wisconsin River Basin. But Matt Kruger says businesses that count on a cleaner river should not have to wait.
You know, it's not a tree-hugging environmentalist issue. There's a lot of business people in the state that rely on their waterfront business.
Kruger says many other communities that are struggling with blue-green algae in their waterways are watching the phosphorus fight in central Wisconsin. Domtar declined our request for comment on the case in Nakusa. Chuck Quernbach, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Thanks, Chuck. Coming up next, we'll talk about the prospect of bookless libraries. I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks, Kristen. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. This is Central Time.
Our digital lives are changing the shape of the world around us, and that includes longstanding institutions like libraries.
Today, some libraries, like the Cleveland Public Library's Tech Central, are responding by going bookless. But what happens to a library when the books go away? And how do publishers and libraries negotiate new terms?
Kevin O'Kelly is a reference and community languages librarian at Somerville Public Library in Massachusetts and a contributor to Huffington Post. And he joins us now to talk about the prospect of bookless libraries. Kevin, welcome.
Thank you.
So bookless libraries are already out there. I haven't seen one yet. Can you tell us a bit about how they work?
Well, they're basically library branches that, instead of rows of bookshelves, they have e-readers and tablets available for members of the public to check out. And then many e-readers will have e-books already downloaded on them, or the patrons will use the e-readers and download an e-book of their choice, one or more, from whatever the library has available. And, you know, the space in itself will consist more of computer terminals than of bookshelves or magazine racks or couches or any of the things we normally, traditionally have seen in libraries.
So it sounds like sort of a stop-and-go kind of place. You come in, you grab the book you want on your e-reader, and then you leave again. So is it losing that sense of being a community gathering space?
I think it can. I mean, it really depends on what people want. For example, many academic libraries at engineering schools have gone bookless. And they're still, you know, for example, at University of Texas San Antonio or Kansas State, you know, these are places where the students like to get together and work and collaborate on projects. Now, for public libraries, it remains to be seen. But, you know, one of the most vital services public libraries provide is exposing children to books. And, you know, all these bookless libraries get compared to Apple stores.
Yeah, what do you think about that comparison?
Well, I don't know anybody who wants to hang out in an Apple store. And I don't know anybody who wants to take their kid to an Apple store for story time, for example. And actually, while we're on the subject of services to children, children's books is one of the areas of the publishing industry where e-books are least popular.
Hmm.
Parents appear to really enjoy, you know, introducing their children to the tactile pleasures of a book, to turning pages and running your hands over paper, looking at, you know, illustrations.
Well, all this kind of begs the question, I mean, what exactly is a public library and how does it function in a community from kids all the way up? I mean, do we have a handle on those questions?
Well, again, it varies from community to community. And, you know, in the case of, for example, the Bibliotheque in Bexar County, we'll just have to see, but I'm guessing that the libraries that want to introduce all digital branches are going to find out that this was a premature step and they might have to take a few steps backward, get a little more retro.
So with a book, a paper book, and let's say you lose it, as God knows has happened to me before, you have to replace it. It's, you know, if it's a kid's book, maybe it's cheap. If not, it, maybe it's a $25 book or something like that. What happens if you break your e-reader?
Yeah, you're out a substantial chunk of change. I mean, even the, you know, the cheapest Kindles cost substantially more than your average trade paperback.
So that could be a deterrent to using these things.
Yes, it could be. And there's also just the simple fact that the vast majority of books out there aren't available as e-books. According to a recent report, half of the top 20 books available for sale on Amazon are not yet available as e-books.
So there's just the question of the books, of the question of stocking of different sorts of things for people to read, it sounds like.
Yeah, it's e-books are still an immature technology. And publishers aren't quite sure what they're doing yet in some respects.
Well, in terms of publishing, let's talk about that for a moment, because this is new turf between libraries and publishers of e-books. It doesn't work the same way as it does having a copy of a paper book. How is this new turf being negotiated right now?
Well, publishers are realizing that they're having to come to terms with libraries because they don't want to, you know, kiss that market goodbye. What seems to really trouble publishers is that an ebook is not something that will obviously need replacing at some point, the way a physical copy of a really popular book like The Hunger Games or 50 Shades of Grey will eventually just wear out. So the response of, for example, Random House has been to charge libraries prices as much as 200% higher than they would for physical books. HarperCollins has taken the step of selling ebooks to libraries that self-destruct after 26 checkouts, arguing that 26 checkouts is about how many checkouts a printed book could stand before it would need to be replaced.
So people are kind of charting their own path.
Yes. Each publisher is taking a slightly different step with libraries, and no one really knows how this is going to play out yet.
Now, Kevin, we're just about out of time. Got about 30 seconds for your answer. But you're a librarian, and I assume your library where you work has the actual physical objects among the computers and some other newer things. How do you feel about this, the idea of a bookless library?
It's not a place that, you know, I would want to work in. Part of it is, you know, just like a lot of people, I have a preference for printed books and a sentimental attachment to them. But I also think that the much vaunted Apple Store atmosphere isn't really what you're looking for in a community center, in a place where you want people to stay. And that's not just me. There was a report recently in the New York Times about libraries in a number of cities that are putting mini libraries in their lobbies. As a way to get people to stay longer
in
the actual
hotel
building.
Going to have to watch and see how libraries evolve. Well, Kevin, thank you so much for joining us.
You're quite welcome. Thank you.
Kevin O'Kelly is a contributor to the Huffington Post and a librarian at Somerville Public Library in Massachusetts.
Coming up, we'll explore the history of soul food. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.